ni wakati wa sisi kupati, wakubwa na wadogo pamoja sogea kati. Ule muda mwafaka umewadia, wote piga kelele nyingi na kushangilia. Selebuka, yeah, kibao kata, ona Johnny kinega kwa mbali anavyanyata. Bado unapiga chabo ni one kinachofuata, pati imevamiwa leo na mwizi wa bata. Achana naye, ila usilemae, kama umekuja kuvuta raha vipi ukae. Fanya makara teo, pata wakucheza naye na kama huna steam.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another edition of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I'm your host Pierce Redmond, and let's get into today's episode. Today's episode is going to be dealing with the Westgate Shopping Mall Massacre, which just happened recently in Westland, Nairobi, and is something that the alternative media has sort of been lacking in its analysis and dissection of the events that transpired at the Westgate Shopping Center. So before we really get into what happened or what really happened there, I thought we could just do a very, very quick overview of the geopolitics of Somalia and a little bit of the history behind Al-Shabaab, which is a group which has claimed responsibility for attacking the Westgate Shopping Center. So just as a very quick overview of Somalia, we're talking about a country which has suffered under virtual occupation and colonization since its very inception. The modern state of Somalia was colonized by the Italians for many, many years, along with certain areas such as Somaliland being controlled by the British. And since its sort of independence, if you could really call that, it suffered under constant invasions by especially its greatest rival, Ethiopia, but also Uganda as well as Kenya. And all three of these countries have invaded Somalia with the backing of the United States government. And along with that, the U.S. government has been meddling in Somali politics since the 90s, essentially, and they've been propping up various despots, they've been conducting drone strikes in Somalia, and the CIA has been running around operating secret torture prisons and using Somalia as a destination for illegal renditions, and virtually has been propping up various different warlords and the sort of fake presidents and prime ministers that they essentially put into place in Somalia. And in 2006, a group known as the Islamic Courts Union, or the ICU, which was an umbrella organization which represented many different Islamist groups and other political groups as well, but, you know, we're talking about Islamist groups, which ran the gambit from, you know, ultra-conservative people that wanted to implement Sharia to what people would, you know, consider moderate groups as well. And the ICU in 2006 was attempting to regain control over Somalia, which had become divided amongst different warlords and political factions, and was being run, these areas were being run as basically personal fiefdoms to the various different actors that were working in Somalia. And the ICU decided to try and regain control. And in 2006, the ICU did seize control of southern Somalia. Now, this terrified the United States, which sees Somalia as basically one of their colonies or one of the nations with which they can use and manipulate for whatever reason that they can come up with. And they encouraged the Ethiopian government and backed them in an invasion of Somalia in 2006. This was a brutal invasion. The Ethiopians basically destroyed the Islamic Courts Union, which, for, you know, however you really want to view the Islamic movement in the Middle East and in North Africa and East Africa, the ICU was certainly better than what existed there at the time. And instead, the Ethiopians, with the U.S. backing, toppled the ICU, destroyed them. And from that, there were lots of different groups that splintered off that were once part of the ICU, and they all went their separate ways. Now, one group in particular that splintered and became extremely influential and powerful was a group known as Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab means the youth in Arabic, and this was, at the time of the ICU in 2006, a very marginal group within the Islamic Courts Union. Now, of course, when it was splintered, the group came to power and saw a rise to power. And, you know, this took the form through, bombings and shootings, and as well as also, like most of these groups, providing services that the warlords simply weren't going to provide. So we're talking about education, health services, distributing food, things of that nature. Now, you know, on face value, one would look at the splintering of the ICU and the rise of Al-Shabaab as somehow horrible and evil. But of course, to the globalist elite that control the world, this is amazing. This is great. This is good for the global war on terror. Of course, this provides yet another boogeyman with which you can focus any of your problems or anything that you want on this amorphous group. This was great for the exploitation of natural resources in the area. Africa is just, flush with minerals, various different elements that are difficult to get a hold of, and increasingly oil. And lastly, this was also great for the expansion of AFRICOM, which is the United States Africa Command. And this is something that we'll touch upon later. But just to, that's just to give you a sort of very quick, broad overview of Somalia and Al-Shabaab. But I would encourage everyone to go out and explore this for yourself. So now let's move on to the Westgate attack itself and what the official government conspiracy theory is on what happened. So according to the Kenyans and, Westerners and all of the various evil entities, the powers that shouldn't be, this was a barbaric siege on Westgate. It resulted in about 70-plus people dying, being murdered. Westerners and non-Muslims were singled out, and there were about 13 different nationalities that basically ran the gambit of every continent on the planet. Along with this, the West and their African colonies, which is Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, proclaimed that the menace of Al-Shabaab was now a major transnational threat, and this threatened the security of the entire world. And this comes on the heels of lots of different reports that have been coming out in the past couple months and in the year that the Al-Shabaab is actually losing the fight in Somalia. They no longer control the coastal regions where they did. They are losing it within the interior. They're being beaten back by Kenyans and Ethiopian and Ugandan special forces and military. But yet, at the same time, we've got the same colonies of the West saying that Al-Shabaab is a massive threat. Now, in the aftermath of this, we also have America planning airstrikes within Somalia, possibly Kenya. We've got the British that are about to send in some sort of special forces team into Somalia to help the fledgling Somali government, which is just a quick aside, the Somali government that all of these people are referring to is basically a few people that are put into place, they are engineered into office by the West and by America in particular, and they control no more than a few city blocks in the capital, Mogadishu. And these are people that are flown in from America and England for elections, and then they leave. And furthermore, AFRICOM, came out and said, oh my god, don't you see, this is why we exist, we need to help and fight these things. And this is, I know this seems very brief and kind of simplistic, but that is the narrative that we are presented with. Al-Shabaab is evil, they are aligned with Al-Qaeda, they went in, they massacred these people, and that's it. There's really nothing else to this. And that's the line that the media uses, that government officials use, and that is the sort of story that they want to implant into your mind, and they want you to tell your friends about that, and they want everyone to be concerned that Al-Shabaab is this huge, ghost-like figure that can come in and commit these evil crimes and recruit young Muslims in the West, in America, in the big Somali populations in America, like in Minnesota and things like that. But I think it's really important to take a second look at this, because there was a lot that went on in Westgate that was reported by, mainstream media even, but that got shoved right down the memory hole, and everyone just sort of read it and, well, that's okay, I don't really care, or, let me get back on, the government might shut down, as we're meant to believe right now. So I think let's now take a look at what H.P. Alberelli, who is a great JFK researcher, would call high strangeness. And first and foremost is the fact that the president of Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta, his fiancé and nephew were in the Westgate Mall when Al-Shabaab attacked, and they were also singled out and murdered. Now, when I read this instantly, I was just almost floored completely. It was just so bizarre that Al-Shabaab would launch this massive, well-coordinated attack, and just so happens that President Kenyatta's fiancé and nephew are there. Well, that's very lucky for Al-Shabaab. Now, nowhere have I been able to find any sort of article which mentions that there were no bodyguards, seemingly. The fiancé and the nephew of the president of Kenya, they walk around without any protection whatsoever. They've got no one, you know, there was no bodyguard to try and fend off these attacks. I think that's a bit strange. And later on, we're going to retouch upon this aspect of the fiancé and the nephew. But for right now, just keep that in the back of your mind. Now, the high strangeness gets even stranger as we start dissecting what was going on and what possibly officials knew prior to the Westgate attack. So I'm going to just, you know, go to the show notes, obviously, for this, because there's going to be a lot of information here, and I don't really want to spend every 5 seconds pointing out this is this article and that article, so go to the show notes. But I'm going to be talking about a couple different aspects, and you can find all of these under an article that was published on Global Research, which was talking about the idea that this could have been a false flag. So I just want to pick apart a few of these. Now, very strange indeed, and relates to why the hell Kenyatta's fiancé and nephew were there, is the fact that the U.S. had very credible evidence, they say, that there was going to be an attack in Kenya, and that it would possibly focus around a shopping center. And this from the wonderful and illustrious NSA. So there was information that was floating around. And now, conceivably, if the U.S. intelligence agencies get information about a terror attack that is dealing with a country that they are extremely close with, i.e. Kenya, you would think that they would pass along that information to them. Now, I don't know. I haven't been able to see anything that says they did pass the information, they didn't pass it, but just, you know, As a reminder, the U.S. had some sort of evidence that there were, or threats, that there was going to be an attack. Now, the Kenyan intelligence agencies themselves supposedly had prior knowledge or foreknowledge that there were going to be attacks, and this is coming from The Guardian. And there are various reports floating around Kenya right now that, yes, in fact, the Kenyan security state did have threats or foreknowledge that there was going to be an attack. And they believed that it was going to be carried out by Al-Hidra, which is the local Kenyan branch of Al-Shabaab. There is a very sizable Somali community within Kenya, particularly in Nairobi. So now we've got the Kenyan intelligence apparatus possibly having information about this, and they never told anybody. What is odd about that is that if it is true, it's very bizarre as to why Kenyatta's fiancé and nephew would be in a mall when there is a possible terror threat. But the high strangeness gets a bit stranger when we see that there are reports that there were Kenyan intelligence agents within the Westgate Mall just hours before the attack. Now, I mean, you've got these reports that they knew that there might be an attack, that the Americans knew there might be an attack, and furthermore, you've got, allegedly, Kenyan intelligence agents in the Westgate Mall. Now, this is going to get even stranger when we see that there was a Harvard graduate who claims that she was rescued by an American security team. I don't know if this has been validated or confirmed. As far as I know, it hasn't, but this Harvard graduate, she works at the World Bank. There's really no reason to doubt her, and she herself grew up in America, or at least studied in America, and she claims that she was rescued by an American security team. So now this raises the question of what was an American security team doing in Kenya, let alone very close to the Westgate Mall, where they could go in and rescue her. But it gets even stranger when we look at an AFP report that, and I remember reading this when the Westgate Mall attack was actually happening, that Israeli special forces were helping Kenyans during the siege, helping to fight these Al-Shabaab militants. Now, allegedly, the Israeli special forces were just in the area on some sort of training exercise. And in the past few years, the Israeli government has become much closer with the Kenyan government. And they, you know, see the common threat of militant Islamic terrorism as, you know, what they can sort of build upon to create a relationship. So now we've got Israeli special forces that just happen to be in Nairobi, very close to the Westgate Mall, and then they come in and they are helping during the siege. Now, AFP reported that they were actually going inside the building. Now, shortly after this report came out, the Times of Israel, in whatever attempt to perhaps, you know, dispel this, said, oh, no, they're just helping to negotiate. They're just helping to negotiate with the al-Shabaab militants. Now, this makes absolutely no sense. Obviously, in any one of these sort of attacks, terrorist events, there is no negotiating process. No one negotiates with al-Qaeda. And it just, I really don't even understand why they would say that they were helping to negotiate. Obviously, the Kenyan government was not going to negotiate. They went in and murdered all of the al-Shabaab militants. But nonetheless, we've got Israeli special forces in the area. Well, we'll just come and help. Now, this, you know, I can understand that this is all sort of, well, you know, maybe they were just there, training exercise, this sort of happens. And again, this sort of training exercise drill meme has been repeated so much in every recent terror attack, speaking about Boston or anything. You know, that whenever these terrorist attacks happen, there is always some sort of training exercise going on. So I think we do have to take pause and sort of look at this critically and maybe not jump to any conclusions on this. If for no other reason, then I don't think it's out of the question to believe that this is a meme that the powers that be propagate, and that they always put that there as a red herring for people to focus on. You know, oh my God, there was a training exercise and then a terrorist attack happened. That's what it was. It was all, that's how the false flag event happened. But here is something that has been reported a lot in various different British media outlets, and this is really a strange one and really does add to the high strangeness of the Westgate attack. This is something I'll read, you know, from the Daily Mail was reporting on this ex-SAS guy, and SAS is the British Special Forces, an ex-SAS officer who just happened to be having a cup of coffee in the Westgate shopping center. You know, this is where he lives, and he was there with a pistol on him, and he helped to save 100 people, and he would, you know, according to the mail, he was running in, he was shooting, then he would, you know, take some people out and then rush back into this mall, and, you know, he saves 100 people. Now, the Independent, The UK Independent claimed that he was actually an off-duty SAS official who, you know, again, I don't, you know, this is, there are very, there, with any of these sort of things, there are always going to be conflicting reports. I think it's a little strange that, you know, we've got, he's ex-SAS, and he's living in Kenya, and he goes to have coffee at the Westgate Mall, and he walks around with a pistol on his, on his pants or whatever, but then we've got, no, he was just off duty. All the same, it's bizarre that we've got this SAS officer who goes in and saves 100 people. And if this is, if you're not really willing to entertain this idea, I just want you to think about this for a minute, that you've got ex or off duty SAS officer who is walking around Kenya with a pistol on him. Now, I don't know much about Kenya or the gun regulations of Kenya, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say that this is probably not normal attire for a Kenyan, let alone a white British man who worked in the British Special Forces, for him to be walking around openly carrying a gun, drinking coffee in a mall, just as al-Shabaab attacks, when we've also got reports of Kenyan special forces or Kenyan intelligence, Israeli special forces all congregating around this area, and possibly an American security team as well. So, I know I just threw a lot of information at you, but there is a lot going on here, and it's a shame that more people aren't really discussing this outright. But now I want to move on to the true height of bizarre circumstances or high strangeness revolving around the Westgate attack. And this is going to be dealing with a woman by the name of Samantha Luthwaite, who is dubbed in the media as the White Widow. Now, I'm referring to her because there were various different reports that came out that described a white woman giving orders in Arabic within the Westgate Shopping Center. There was a white woman who was commanding the Al-Shabaab militants in Arabic. And this is allegedly confirmed by various different witnesses who were inside there who saw her doing this. Now, the second that this, you know, white woman giving orders to Al-Shabaab, the media turned their focus to Samantha Luthwaite. Now, who is Samantha Luthwaite? She is a British-born woman who converted to Islam, I believe, in her late teens, perhaps early 20s. Now, a few years before 2005, she met a man by the name of Jermaine Lindsay in an internet chat room that was discussing Islam. Now, they married and had two children. In 2005, Jermaine Lindsay was implicated as one of the alleged bombers of the London Underground, which was known as the 7/7 bombing. Now, Jermaine Lindsay was obviously killed in the 7/7 bombing, so he can't speak for himself, but Samantha Luthwaite did speak for him and went out to British media and was paid about £30,000 to give an interview to a British newspaper where she expressed her total, complete agreement with the British government that Jermaine Lindsay was one of the bombers and he carried it out. He was an evil, heartless man who committed this barbaric terrorist attack. Now, this differs with all the other relatives of the alleged bombers in 7/7. All of the other relatives expressed serious doubts. They could not understand how their brother or nephew or husband could ever be involved in something like this. And I think it's really important, if you haven't done any research into 7/7, go out, and I'll of course provide this in the show notes, but watch Tom Secker's documentaries on 7/7, and he spends time in his documentaries as well as in interviews and articles, and I'll provide these later, on Samantha Luthwaite in general. But if you do take your time and look into the 7/7 bombing, you will see that these men were either witting or unwitting dupes of the intelligence services of MI6, that there is just no way that they could have carried this out all on their own. And in fact, all of the alleged bombers have some sort of connection to MI6, to the intelligence services. But anyway, so we've got Samantha Luthwaite, and she's dubbed the White Widow after her husband blows himself up and kills scores and scores of people. And she, admits, oh, he's a terrorist, he's horrible. This man that, she supposedly knew and had his children with and whatever. Now, in 2007, so about 2 years after the 7/7 bombing, Samantha Luthwaite moves to none other than Kenya. And she moves there with an acquaintance of her by the name of Habib Saleh Khani. And she travels all over the continent, but particularly in East Africa. So in Kenya, in Uganda, and eventually ends up in Somalia. And during this time, she has a third child. Around the time of this other child and her time in Somalia, she allegedly joins up with Al-Shabaab. Now, before we go any deeper on this, let's just take a second and just reevaluate this. So we've got a white woman with three mixed-race children who is joining up with Al-Shabaab militants in Somalia after she denounces her husband as a brutal terrorist. Okay, so back to the story. Now, Luthwaite is supposedly, you know, running around. There are reports that she is helping to recruit people to Al-Shabaab. Presumably, she's helping to recruit Westerners, Americans, British, converts to Islam or people who are Muslim. And, you know, she's trying to help them to join up and fight. And it's around 2011 that there is a raid on a bomb factory in Mombasa, Kenya. And Mombasa is the second largest city of Kenya. It's right on the coast. And there is this raid on a bomb factory where Luthwaite was alleged to have been running a terror cell. Now, Luthwaite escapes. You know, she's able to somehow get out. Another person who was with her by the name of Jermaine Grant, he is arrested and is kept basically incommunicado by the Kenyan authorities. Now, when they are going through this bomb factory in Mombasa, they find a fake passport. On the passport is a picture of Samantha Luthwaite, but the information is that of just some regular run-of-the-mill British woman living in England. And along with this are thousands and thousands of dollars in cash, as well as a diary written, supposedly, by Luthwaite, in which she talks about how she wants her children to grow up to be suicide bombers and, you know, kill all of the infidels and whatnot. Now, when most people are supposedly working with a terrorist organization and they have their house or their bomb factory raided, and in it you find a fake passport with a name that belongs to a real person and bags of cash, this points to one thing, and that is an intelligence operative. This is how the CIA operates. This is how the Mossad works. This is how MI6 works. Especially the idea of a fake passport that belongs to a real actual person. And you can look back to the assassination of a Hamas official in Dubai that was carried out by Mossad agents. And in that attack, there were something like 10 or 11 different Mossad agents, and all of them had fake passports that belonged to real people in other countries. This is how the intelligence service operates. It's much better to forge a passport, but using a real person, than to just simply create a whole new identity. Now, in the past few days, Interpol has issued a red notice for Samantha Luthwaite, and this is in connection to her possession of explosives and conspiracy to commit a felony dating back to this original 2007 raid in Mombasa. Now, again, I feel like we just have to reiterate this. How does a white woman with three mixed-race children run around East Africa fighting and coordinating with Al-Shabaab and elude arrest from the authorities for years and years, at least since 2007 when she moved there? But certainly after 2011, a white woman with three mixed-race children, she's able to drag these kids along through Somalia, Kenya, presumably if she was really commanding the attack at the Westgate Mall. How is she able to elude the authorities? This is very bizarre. And for a little bit more on this, I would really suggest that everyone go out and listen to Tom Secker's new podcast, which is called Clandestime. And it focuses on his exploration of the security state and of all of these strange events that happen and the connection that almost all, if not all, terrorists have to the security state itself. And in this, he points out a fact that goes missing in every news report that deals with Samantha Luthwaite, and that's the fact that her father was part of the British Army's counterterrorism unit and was stationed in Northern Ireland during Britain's other war on terror, which is known as the Troubles. And for anyone that does any research into the Troubles and MI6 and Britain's role in that, you'll see the same sort of thing, that you've got, you know, the British Secret Service was infiltrating the IRA and helping them to carry out bombings and to set them up and to arrest them and assassinate people. So it's a bit odd that Samantha Luthwaite marries a terrorist, then denounces terrorism, then drags her three children all over Somalia and then gets involved with a terrorist organization. Oh, and her father was part of a clandestine organization that infiltrated terrorists. So again, I would go to Tom Secker's podcast, and in that he also touches upon the idea that was used by the British during the Mau Mau uprising, and that was the gangs and counter-gang strategy, which was basically a plan that was put forth by the British government where they would infiltrate the various different Mau Mau groups, and they would then convert other Mau Mau. You know, basically, you're going to work with us now, or else we're going to murder your family, or however they would do it, money and whatnot. And then they would use these converted Mau Maus as counter gangs to the Mau Mau gangs. And they would use them to assassinate leaders within the Mau Mau uprising and you know, the Mau Mau movement. They would ambush various different fighters. And he makes a very, I think, logical and strong connection between the whole gang counter gang strategy and what's been going on with Al-Shabaab recently. Now, for anyone that is following this or following Al-Shabaab, you'll know that there have been these mysterious ambushes of prominent Al-Shabaab members. In particular is a guy who's called Al-Amriki, which is referring to the American. And this was a white guy who lived in America and then converted to Islam and then moved to Somalia. And he was famous for putting out all of these videos on YouTube where he would, like, you know, he would rap about Islamic terrorism and Sharia law and whatnot. And he then started putting out videos saying that he was fearing for his life, that he no longer felt safe in Al-Shabaab, and was later ambushed and killed by Al-Shabaab members. And you also see that the head of Al-Shabaab has been assassinated and a new person has come into power. So it's very interesting. And Tom Secker, if you don't know anything about him, please, please go to his website, investigatingtheterror.com and spyculture.com. There's so much information there. And his films are just perfect. They're just phenomenal. And he is so good at dissecting the security state and dissecting all of these little, you know, connections between these alleged terrorists and groups like MI6, the CIA, and whatnot. Anyway, I think that the high strangeness has been illustrated to you. This, you know, we've got the White Widow, who is just, nothing makes sense about that. We've got Israeli special forces there. We've got an ex-SAS officer walking around with a pistol saving people. We've got reports that the Kenyans had prior knowledge of this, that the NSA had prior knowledge of this, and yet this all happened. And just for a last little bit of the high strangeness, let's also take a moment and look at the fact that there are still 70 people missing from the Westgate attack. 70 people that are just unaccounted for. And believe me, Kenyans are very upset about this. And, you know, the Kenyan people are wondering these same questions. Where are these 70 people? And even more to that point, they have not released any names or pictures of any of the Al-Shabaab militants that were there. They were just killed and, according to some reports, dumped in a big crater that was once part of the Westgate shopping center. So I think we've been able to kind of scratch the surface of this, and unfortunately there just simply isn't that much information out there. And this is mainly due to the fact that the Kenyan authorities have placed a basically complete media blackout. They are not telling the media anything about what happened at Westgate. They're keeping everything hush-hush. They're not revealing what they did know, what they didn't know. And if you go through the show notes and read some of these articles, you'll see various different Kenyan members of parliament talking about how the intelligence services are more concerned with the inner workings of the various political parties in Kenya and not actually concerned with groups such as Al-Shabaab or any sort of terrorist threat. So I think in the last couple minutes now, let's just sort of try and sum up what this means, if this attack was allowed to happen, or if it was planned, or if, you know, why? Why was this the case? Now, the most obvious reason is the destabilization of Africa. And this is what the globalists always want, is to destabilize countries. But, you know, if you're paying attention to the news, to the real news, you'll see that this has been going on in Africa now for the past couple of years. And, you know, as I've mentioned before in other podcasts, we saw the destabilization going on in the Ivory Coast. And, you know, basically the globalist puppet was put in place there. They got rid of Laurent Gbagbo in Ivory Coast, who was seen as, you know, kind of critical of things like the IMF and Wall Street and whatnot. And then we see the destabilization in Mali going on. Obviously, the war in Libya has completely destabilized that nation and has opened it up as a basic, you know, CIA training operation for Al-Qaeda members and then ship them off to Syria. Obviously, Egypt, the coup there. But also in East Africa, obviously, Somalia is completely destabilized. There is no law and order there at all. And this is what the globalists want. They want to destabilize Africa. They, you know, God forbid these people ever do something that, you know, would help enrich their lives. Now, as I said in the beginning of the podcast, Africa is, of course, just beyond, you know, wealthy with minerals, things like zinc. We've got all sorts of metals that are used in the manufacture of cell phones and computers that come from Congo and other places. Increasingly, oil is being discovered everywhere. You know, obviously, we've got Nigeria is full of oil. South Sudan is, you know, exploding with oil. Chad apparently now has found oil. And then this must be exploited by the global elite. But something that was brought to my attention by Thomas Sheridan in his podcast is the idea of water as the new natural resource that is going to be fought over by this, you know, global elite. And he has been talking about this a lot lately. And, you know, when I first heard it, I was like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, you know, I always assume, you know, yeah, water wars are a real thing. But I didn't really think much of it when he first mentioned it. Except that he later talked about this massive aquifer that was discovered in Kenya. And, you know, I'll go and read about it for yourself in the show notes, but there is a massive aquifer in Kenya. And when this was first discovered, you know, you saw all of these reports. Oh, how wonderful for the Kenyans. They'll no longer have water shortages, which is a very serious problem in East Africa, especially in Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, Eritrea. All of these countries are faced with severe water shortages. And then, you know, the BBC and the New York Times and everyone was, oh my God, this is great. They've got water now. But if you start looking a little bit deeper and you start really, you know, paying attention, you've got the CEO of Nestle who came out and said water is not a human right, and that the complete and utter privatization of water and basically controlling the water supply so you could sell more bottled water to people is totally within reason, and there's nothing wrong with that. And if you, you know anything about Nestle, they are probably one of the most evil multinational corporations on the planet. But I think it's good to point these things out. You know, you hear a lot about, oh, it's about oil, it's about this, you know, uranium, that's the big one in Mali right now. You've also got gold there as well. But I think that it's important to, you know, pick out these little tiny bits of information that you get in the news, like, oh, a massive aquifer in Kenya. Oh, the CEO of Nestle wants to control all of the water and exploit it. And then, oh my God, you've got this huge terror attack, which, you know, is meant to destabilize Kenya, therefore making it much easier for Nestle to go in, or any, you know, organization to go in and exploit the natural resources of the vast and rich continent of Africa. And this idea of destabilization and exploitation of mineral resources also goes along with AFRICOM. And I mentioned that at the beginning of the episode, and I would suggest everyone go out or go and read the articles that I have by Tony Cartolucci, who's been just excellent on this, from Land Destroyer. Also some pretty good stuff from Tom Dispatch, which I don't really usually read very much anymore, but Nick Turse has been very good about reporting on AFRICOM. And AFRICOM, for anyone who doesn't know, and I, you know, I'm not pointing fingers at anybody, because I would say that, you know, almost no one really understands what AFRICOM is or what's going on with AFRICOM. But over the past few years, AFRICOM under Obama has just exploded, and they are certainly creating a empire of bases, which is what, you know, Chalmers Johnson would always talk about, the empire of bases. And the empire of bases in Africa is just insane. And AFRICOM is now everywhere. And of course, if you go and talk to anyone from AFRICOM, they'll tell you, oh, what, you're nuts. We're in one little base, Camp Lemonnier, something like that, in Djibouti, and that's it, and it's very small, and we're just trying to help everybody. But of course, then you've also got AFRICOM hunting for Joseph Kony, somewhere, who even knows if he's alive. But you've got AFRICOM popping up in Burkina Faso. They have a new base. They certainly have lots of bases in South Sudan. And AFRICOM has been in the process of militarizing the whole entire continent, helping to prop up corrupt leaders, helping to quote-unquote train various different military forces within Africa, but basically just running amok and hopefully trying to recolonize Africa for the American military-industrial complex. And, of course, this is great business. You know, Lockheed Martin and Boeing and General Dynamics are going to make a killing out of all of the contracts that are going to be signed between AFRICOM and these various African countries. So basically, what I'm just trying to paint you this picture that, you know, you might look at Westgate, and even if you're into the alternative media, even if you can question the official government conspiracy theory with an alternative conspiracy theory, I think a lot of people haven't really focused much on Westgate. But I think it's really important to remember that Kenya is extremely close with the West. Kenya is a big partner on the global war on terror, and an event like this only goes, you know, forward with strengthening Kenya, and with, of course, with providing more evidence and more reason to continue the global war on terror. To, you know, we need this, and you can see that as this was, you know, counter gang and gang activity, the way that the British did in Kenya. Again, the Mau Maus were in Kenya. Or you could see this as they let it happen. And I think that the idea that the Kenyans let this happen, you're going to see a little bit more of that in the coming days. You're going to see the ubiquitous, oh, this was an intelligence failure. If only we had more money, this wouldn't have happened. And then the Kenyan authorities would have been able to communicate more. And again, just quickly, I think it's very important to note that the information that the Americans had about this attack was linked to the NSA, which is under tremendous heat right now for spying on virtually the entire world. And of course, it has to be the NSA that is here to say, oh, you see, this is why we need the NSA, so we can stop Al-Shabaab from attacking. So I know that's a lot of information, and I just want to, you know, one quick little thing, and that's going back, and I said we would do this, is to Uhuru Kenyatta's fiancé and nephew being murdered. And if you don't know much about Uhuru Kenyatta, he is wanted by the ICC, the International Criminal Court, for inciting political violence after he was recently elected. Now, Kenyatta, like almost, if not all, African leaders, understands that the ICC is nothing other than a corrupt, racist, globalist organization, which is basically put in place to try African leaders and to put them in jail and to put people in place that will favor a Western globalist regime. Now, Kenyatta, along with the African Union, was said, I do not respect the ICC, I don't believe in it, and I'm not going to be a victim of it. So, and Tony Cartolucci points this out, that who knows, maybe this is a message to him, because of course now Kenyatta is just, he's you know, looking for, oh my God, I need more international support, I need more people here, I need this, I need that, and I don't know, maybe this is a, you know, some sort of a message to him that, oh, you see, yeah, now you want the ICC, and you want these international bodies to be there, and of course this is speculation, but, you know, I think it's okay, and if it's coming from Tony Cartolucci, it's pretty informed speculation. So, as I see right now, I've been talking for quite a bit, and there's a lot of information here. So please go through the show notes. And before I sign off, I just want to say, if you like the podcast, please tell your friends about it. You can contact me through the contact forum. You can email me on porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. If you have a WordPress, please follow me. If you're on Twitter, follow me at porkinspolicy. And, you know, I tweet all the time about, you know, all sorts of, a range of different issues that I haven't even gotten to discuss yet on the podcast. And please, you know, go and read Porkin's Policy Review. I've got some new articles up, and I know that I say this like every single time that, tune in next week or whatever, and this has been weeks since I've had another podcast. It's just really difficult to do it, but I do promise that I'm going to have more content up very soon. We're going to have a new political cartoon that's going to be featured hopefully every week, but again, don't quote me on it. And that's going to be done by my sister, and they're really, really funny, very, just great cartoons that we're going to have up. With that, I think I'm going to say goodbye, and we'll see you very soon, hopefully. Natond in your jungle, Ojita. De set a jungle, Ziboy. Hallelujah. We'll be right back.
Jungle, the boy, Onyange.